Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Preaching peace. As the world celebrates the UN Day for Peace, Pope Benedict urges a new impetus towards self-critical dialogue among world religions. Dialogue in practice. Muslims and Christians around the table in Lebanon. Hi, everyone. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me today. Those will be the stories we're going to be looking at over the next half hour. Thursday marks the UN-sponsored International Day for Peace. And among the many events planned here in Rome to mark the occasion, a march of Dominicans down the city's cobblestone streets to the Colosseum. Master General of the Dominican Order, Brother Carlos Aspiros Costa, told us the march is in step with Pope Benedict's own words for peace.
The first speech or message from Benedict XVI, the Day of Peace, which the Catholic Church celebrates the Day of Mother of God, January 1st, the subject, the title of his message is In Truth, Peace. And war always covers lies, always, because war is also the work of the evil, who is the accusator of our brothers, according to St. John in the Apocalypse. Jesus Christ is defensor, defensor pacis, defensor fidei, is our defensor. This is why we are making this day of peace, and we will walk. There's a little sign, perhaps we will be few people, but we are a family, and we have a family in Middle East, we have family in Egypt, we have family in Iraq, we have family in Iran, in Tehran, just preaching the gospel, nothing else.
Just preaching the gospel is what Pope Benedict does every day, and his catechesis at the traditional Wednesday General Audience this week was no different. Except this Wednesday, the Pope also felt the need to further clarify his recent words to scholars at the University of Regensburg, Germany. One quotation cited in the Pope's lengthy speech there on faith and reason had been widely misinterpreted. Speaking to pilgrims in St. Peter's Square on Wednesday, the Pope explained why he chose the words of a Byzantine emperor to communicate the need for all religions to use reason and not violence as a vehicle of expressing their faiths.
And this is one of the key points that the Holy Father wants to make, that there is no reasonable way one can explain violence or justify violence by using religious arguments.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. He addressed the second session of the UN's Human Rights Council there on Monday to reassure Muslim and other members that the Holy Father had in no way wished to offend Islam. But let's listen first to what the Pope had to say Wednesday in St. Peter's Square. Catherine Smybert filed this report.
Pope Benedict said he selected his words and quotes for the speech in order to introduce his listeners to the importance and pertinence of the subject of religion and violence.
I included a quotation on the relationship between religion and violence. This quotation, unfortunately, was misunderstood. In no way did I wish to make my own the words of the medieval emperor. I wish to explain that not religion and violence, but religion and reason go together.
The Holy Father recognized that the words of the emperor may sound incomprehensibly abrupt to our ears, but said that his intention was to present the element of the quote which emphasizes how it's reason, not force, that should guide the transmission of faith. Here the Pope went on to quote from the Second Vatican Council document Nostra Aetate, which focuses on interreligious dialogue.
I hope that my profound respect for world religions and for Muslims, who worship the one God, and with him we promote peace, liberty, social justice, and moral values for the benefit of all humanity, is clear.
Pope Benedict said he trusted that after the initial reaction to his Regensburg lecture, that his words can constitute an impulse and encouragement toward positive and even self-critical dialogue among faiths and cultures in our world today.
Let us continue the dialogue both between religions and between modern reason and the Christian faith.
Well, it seems the misunderstanding over the Pope's words may, in fact, have had one very positive outcome: new impetus to interfaith dialogue, with a clear call to people of every religion to engage in the conversation with an open, self-critical mind. Well, it was with an open mind that Archbishop Tomasi was inviting members of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva to consider the Pope's Regensburg address. He said most would agree with the Pope that there is no reasonable way to justify violence by using religious arguments.
And I think on this point there is a general consensus on the part of Muslims as well. And in fact, the statement has been accepted quite well, not only by all the ambassadors, but in particular by the Muslim countries' ambassador. So I think this effort to place the whole discussion in a broader context of human rights for all believers, that they may want to express their right to believe individually or in community, this is something the international community has to respect, because the whole context of the discussion was exactly the Council for Human Rights. And second, that we have to go beyond the present confrontation that developed out of misunderstanding, because some of the manifestations took place even before any translation of the Pope's address were made available in the languages of any of the people demonstrating. So there was some emotional response rather than an action based on factual evidence. So beyond that, I think we need to look forward, and I said that the road ahead calls for even deeper knowledge of other faiths and culture, and for religious literacy on the part of everybody, meaning that people have to know the religious beliefs of others, and on the basis of that, start a more meaningful dialogue. And in fact, to really understand some of the current emotional outbursts and demonstration, I think we need to take into account also the social condition and the problems that prompt people to use religion in the wrong way.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations office in Geneva. Well, we've been speaking to a number of other analysts to try to understand why one phrase in a lengthy papal discourse could have provoked the kind of unrest we've seen in recent days, and to see where the interreligious dialogue goes from here. Susie Hodges has more.
Catholics and Muslims say it's important to move forward and continue along the path of dialogue between their two faiths. This was in essence the message I got when I spoke to two experts on interreligious dialogue, one Catholic and the other Muslim. Father Daniel Madigan is the director of the Institute for the Study of Religions at the Pontifical Gregorian University and consultant on relations with Muslims for the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. He says we need to look at the broader issue of why many radical Muslims harbour resentment against the West, rather than just focusing on this one incident.
I think the first thing we need to do is to recognise that the anger that's being expressed is not simply the anger about that particular speech of the Holy Father. There's a great deal of anger in the Muslim world, which is connected with many issues, and some of them very long-standing issues, to do with the frustrations about development, the division of the world into two blocks, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are so many issues. So I think if we just focus on repairing the damage that was caused in this incident, I think we'll miss the point. We need to address the larger issues.
Mario Scirloia is a leading member of the Italian World Muslim League and a former diplomat. He says the political agenda of many Islamic fundamentalists in poor countries is feeding this anger and what he terms the excessive reaction among Muslims to the Pope's remarks.
Well, the Pope already expressed, let's say, his sorrow for what happened and said with great authority that those few words do not respect at all his thought. So this should be enough. As you know, that there are fundamentalist movements in the Islamic world that can exploit any incident or anything just to pursue their campaign of hate against the West in general. And unfortunately, there are many youth in the poor Islamic countries who do not have a future in their life, who have evidently some hate against the rich West, and that they follow these fundamentalist movements. So that's why the reaction against those few words taken out from the Pope's speech in Ratisbon raised so much publicity and reactions, even from political people, even from head of governments. But I think, the reaction in the Islamic world, by and large, was quite unreasonable and quite excessive.
In Father Daniel's view, there is another factor that is fueling this anger among Muslims around the world.
One of the things I think that fuels anger is people really feel they're not being heard, that they're not being understood, that they're not being taken seriously as people who believe. And so dialogue has to take place between people. You can't have dialogue between systems of thought, and you can't have dialogue simply from historical texts, people dialogue. And so it's very important, I think, to give people the sense that they are being listened to. And this reminds me of something that Pope Paul VI underlined in his encyclical Ecclesiam Suam. He said that the first step in dialogue is to listen to what people have to say and what they have it in their hearts to say.
But it's not just a question of listening and entering into a theological dialogue with Muslims. Father Daniel says this dialogue also needs to take into account how we behave and interact with people of other faiths.
Well, I think anything we can do is a form of dialogue. Not all dialogue means sitting down and talking about issues. We believe as Christians that God's revelation is incarnate, that is to say, it's expressed in the flesh. And so we have to express our respect and our openness also in the flesh, which doesn't mean that you strike up a theological conversation with a Muslim. What it means is that it's about the way you greet people. It's about the way you deal with them on a day-to-day basis. All that counts.
But what kind of feedback have both of them received from individual Muslims in the wake of this misunderstanding?
We have quite a number of Muslim students in our institute here. About a third of our students are Muslims who come to study Christianity and to prepare themselves to work in interreligious dialogue. Well, they're in their own countries, most of them at the moment, because of the vacation. They tell me that they've been trying to do some damage control, as they call it, telling people about their own positive experience and saying that they know the Vatican. They know many people even who work in the Vatican, and they know that this quotation from the emperor doesn't represent the Pope's personal position on Islam, nor does it represent their experience of the warm welcome and respect they've had here. So they're trying to make present for people that personal relationship, which is so important in dialogue.
In Italy, you know that about 90% of the Muslim community are people that came here to work, to find a future for themselves and for their sons. and do not follow very, very much, I mean, what happens throughout the world. All the reactions I got was evidently of a criticism for these few words that the Pope said, but also of understanding that they do not correspond to a change of line in the policy of the Vatican.
Scialoia says he's confident that relations between Catholics and Muslims will rapidly return to normal after what he calls this storm in a teacup.
Or surely it will pick up again. Unfortunately, a few words from the lesson that the Holy Father gave to the university in Germany have been widely dramatized and publicized by certain mass media. Without any doubt, those words, taken singularly by themselves, are rather offensive for the Islamic religion. But it's illegitimate to take them out of the context, out of the full speech that the Holy Father delivered. If we put them in the right frame, we see that the Pope is always on the same line of his predecessor, a line of dialogue and respect for Islam as a great religion. So I think it has been a very unhappy episode that the mass media created in a way. I think that after this, let's say, storm in a glass of water, I think that things will go back to normal as before. Benedict XVI gave ample proof up to now about his will to continue on the road of dialogue.
That was Mario Scialoia, a leading member of the Italian World Muslim League. And you also heard the voice of Father Daniel Madigan, director of the Institute for the Study of Religions at the Pontifical Gregorian University. And I'm Susie Hodges.
While Pope Benedict is urging renewed energy and self-criticism in interfaith dialogue, there are some Muslims and Christians in the Middle East who have never stopped the conversation. As director of the Islamic and Christian Studies Department at St. Joseph's University in Beirut, Father Salah Abu Jaudeh keeps the classrooms buzzing. His 40-some students, half Muslims from the Middle East and North Africa, and half Christians from the region, set the record straight for each other on their faiths and lay the groundwork for greater understanding and for peace.
We have two main programs. First of all, what we can say a very classical program, we provide courses to study Islam and Christianity and methods for how to enter into an objective and fruitful dialogue, but also to lead the students to appreciate the richness of cultural and religious differences. The Institute believes that by providing such courses, students can identify the prejudgments, the discriminations, the stereotypes that influence, maybe consciously but especially unconsciously, the way each member or even each group of the society understands other groups or members, mainly during crisis. So this is the first program we have. The second one we started 2 years ago. It's a specialized program on dialogue, mainly for teachers of religion, Christians and Muslims, and for directors of educational, social, or welfare establishments. At least, until now, 75 persons followed the program. We hope by this academic formation to enlarge mutual understanding and cooperation between the participants, so they, in their turn, can play a more efficient and objective role among their pupils. They can train their consciences in the direction of peace, reconciliation, and concord. As well, we try to reach a larger public by our other activities, such as conferences, forums online, roundtables, that we organize regularly.
Just a curiosity, Father. When you have these students sitting together, side by side, Muslims and Christians, do you ever have any arguments? Do people discuss the Quran and the Bible and disagree over things?
In fact, that depends on the subject. Usually, when we introduce the Bible or the Quran, we don't have arguments because for most of them, they are about to hear something new. They are about to hear something that they need to know. So at this level, usually we don't have any arguments. The arguments start in general when religion and politics go together, when we cannot avoid the separation between some religious subjects from, for example, social and political subjects. When we speak of Palestine, when we speak of the relation between East and West, that might cause some arguments. But in general, we handle them. We have a long experience. The teachers are well ready to handle these situations.
But can this small-sized interfaith dialogue operate on a national level, involving all 17 of Lebanon's different confessions? All were divided into different alliances during the horrific years of civil war that tore Lebanon apart. I wondered if it is faith or politics which determine the path towards reconciliation in Lebanon, a process that never seemed to get off the ground since the conflict ended in 1990.
Well, here, in fact, the national dialogue is a political process par excellence and concerns the different current political forces or blocs. These forces do not have necessarily a confessional color or a specific confessional color. So as an academic institution, we do not get involved in such a process. We work only at academic level. A national dialogue is a political process.
My experience with the Lebanese has been really that they never really seem to have had a true process of reconciliation after that long civil war that brought Lebanon to its knees. I'm thinking of reconciliation processes like the ones we saw in South Africa, perhaps Rwanda, Mozambique. Was there anything that prevented a national reconciliation process?
Well, in fact, I must say two things to start. First of all, we should not forget that Lebanon as a state was founded in 1920. So somehow it's a new country. Moreover, Lebanon underwent a multifaceted war from 1975 until 1990. It wasn't a purely a civil war. The war in 1975, for instance, started between Christian militias and the Palestinians. It was not between Lebanese. These things are to be underlined first. Second, the modern history of the country shows that Lebanese, in fact, are fully capable of attaining sustainable compromises as long as external interferences are neutralized. In addition, whenever we talk about national dialogue, we should always put it in its particular context. The Israeli army withdrew from the south in May 2000. The Syrian army left the country in April 2005. So the Lebanese didn't have the opportunity to meet each other in an ambience of liberty during decades. Syria was the power broker in Lebanon for three decades. Now, for the recent war, before the recent war, a national dialogue, in fact, has been inaugurated at the initiative of the Speaker of the House, Mr. Nabih Berri. It would be wrong, however, to think that it was a dialogue between confessions, although confessionalism was and still present and deeply rooted in national life. To be more accurate, we have to speak of dialogue between different political currents. If I have the time, I can explain what I mean.
Yes, please do. Mm-hmm.
So the parliamentary elections of May and June in 2005 broke down into three strong blocks. First, the Future Movement, Which
Wait,
is
let's
gathering.
Go. Let's go back 1 second. This is a new political scene since the death, the assassination of the former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri back in February 2005.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Everything changed after that moment.
Exactly. There was the retreat of the Syrian army, and then in May and June 2005, we had the parliamentary elections. These elections broke down into three strong blocks. First, there is the Future Movement, which is a gathering of Sunni, Druze, and some Christians, led by Mr. Saad Hariri, the son of the assassinated former prime minister, and Walid Jumblat, the Druze leader. This bloc took 72 seats out of 128. This gathering is usually called March 14 Forces. Then there was the Shiite Amal Hezbollah bloc, led by Mr. Birri and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. They secured the 35 seats. And finally, the Free Patriotic Movement, and we can say overwhelmingly Christian bloc, led by General Michel Aoun, took 21 seats. So nearly 1 year after elections, political tension rose between Hariri's anti-Syrian bloc and the combined General Aoun and Hezbollah blocs. So it's not a purely confessional tension. This political alignment led to an impasse on several key issues and was accompanied by a subsequent chain of assassinations of anti-Syrian figures like George Hawi, like Samir Qasir, like Gibran Twaini, which polarized Lebanese society and paralyzed official decision-making. So at that critical time, Mr. Birri, noticed by his moderate position, was encouraged, in fact, by several internal and external forces alike, to take the initiative to call for a national dialogue. Participants in that dialogue included important figures of Lebanese politics from all confessions, Mr. Hariri himself, Jumblat, Nasrallah, Aoun, Birri, the current Prime Minister, Mr. Senoura, Samir Jaja, the leader of the Lebanese forces, Mr. Amin Jmayr, the former President of the Republic, and other figures. And in fact, the group was able to reach consensus on certain important issues. For instance, they agreed on the need to normalize the relations with Syria, including establishing Syrian and Lebanese embassies in Beirut and Damascus. As you know, Syria has always said that the two countries did not need embassies in each other's capitals because of their close relationship, because of their joint history. Second, they agreed to collect Palestinian weapons outside of refugee camps within 6 months. That was already in last March. Thirdly, they agreed to discuss a replacement candidate for the current president of the republic, General Emil Lahoud, who is accused by the parliamentarian majority of being appointed by Syrian pressure. But they didn't reach an agreement as to the name of the candidate. They needed much more time. Unfortunately, the war of July came to end up the ambience favorable of the national dialogue, without meaning that the Lebanese are not capable of resuming their talks. I hope they will do that soon.
And that was Jesuit Father Salah Abu Jaudeh, Director of the Institute of Islamic and Christian Studies at St. Joseph's University in Beirut. Well, if the national dialogue is to resume in Lebanon, much will depend on how the country heals the physical and the psychological wounds of the recent war between Israel and Hezbollah. Much will also likely depend on the extent to which the Lebanese are ready to leave political and religious infighting aside for the good of their nation. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.